Some monsters don't hide in the shadows. They don't lurk in dark alleys or abandoned buildings. They don't wear their evil on their face. They don't announce themselves. Sometimes they sit across the dinner table. They run businesses. They raise families. They wave to neighbors from the driveway. They show up at church on Sunday. They shake hands at community events. They smile for the camera. And sometimes they keep secrets buried so deep, so deliberately, so carefully concealed that it takes years, sometimes many, many years, for the truth to finally surface. Tonight's story is one of disappearance, of suspicion, of silence, of a community that refused to stop asking questions, and of a discovery so chilling, so deeply disturbing, it stunned an entire county and reminded all of us that the most dangerous place in the world is sometimes the home you share with the person you once promised forever to. This is the story of Dee Warner. Welcome back to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. And if you're new here, this is the podcast where we don't flinch, where we sit in the uncomfortable darkness of true crime, and we stay there long enough to actually understand it. Not just the facts, not just the timeline, but the human cost, the psychology, the ripple effect that moves through families like a shockwave and never fully fades. We tell these stories because they deserve to be told, because the victims deserve to be remembered as people, not just case numbers, not just headlines, not just statistics in a database somewhere. And tonight, that person is Dee Warner, a mother, a businesswoman, a daughter, a friend, a woman who, by all accounts, was full of life until the day she wasn't. Tonight, we're going deep. We're going slow. We're going to walk through every layer of this case because Dee Warner's story is not just about a crime. It's about the warning signs we miss, the silences we tolerate, the questions we're afraid to ask. So settle in, turn up the volume, because tonight, we're going all the way in. To understand what happened to Dee Warner, you have to understand the world she lived in. Lanawi County, Michigan. Tucked in the southeastern corner of the state. It's the kind of place that doesn't make national news very often. The stretch of farmland, small towns, wide open property. The kind of place where everybody knows your name. Where businesses pass through families for generations. And where trust is built slowly, and once broken, takes a very long time to repair. Dee Warner was woven into that community. People who knew her described her as warm, energetic, the kind of woman who could hold a conversation with anyone and make them feel like the most important person in the room. She had a laugh that people remembered. She had opinions she wasn't afraid to share. She loved her children fiercely, and she worked hard, genuinely hard, not just in the background, but side by side in the operations that kept her family's business moving. Because the Warners weren't just a family, they were a business enterprise. Dee and her husband Dale Warner ran farming and trucking operations out of their property in Lanawi County, agriculture and transportation. The kind of businesses that require long hours, physical work, trust between partners, and the ability to make hard decisions under pressure. On the surface, the Warner operation looks stable, successful, even. The kind of rural American story that gets romanticized. A couple building something together from the ground up. But surfaces can lie. And beneath the image of stability, people close to the situation would later describe something different. Tension, the kind that doesn't erupt all at once, but builds slowly, like pressure in a sealed space. Financial disagreements, disputes over how the business should be run, questions about direction, questions about the future, and perhaps most critically, questions about whether Dee and Dale's marriage had reached a point of no return. People who knew Dee say she wasn't one to suffer in silence. She wasn't the kind of woman who would simply accept a situation that made her unhappy. And in the months leading up to April of 2021, people in her circle sensed that something was shifting, that Dee was considering her options, that she was thinking about what came next, that she may have been preparing to make a change. And in too many cases, in far too many cases, that is exactly when the danger peaks. Not when the relationship is bad, but when someone decides to leave. I want you to hold on to that image of Dee for a moment. Before we get into timelines and evidence and courtroom proceedings, before this becomes a case study, think about her as a person. A woman who got up every morning and worked a real job alongside the man she married, who balanced the books and managed relationship and held things together in ways that people often don't acknowledge until those things start falling apart. A mother whose children visited on Sundays, not because they had to, because they wanted to. That kind of relationship, that weekly ritual, it doesn't happen by accident. It's the product of years of showing up, years of being present, years of being someone worth showing up for. That's who Dee Warner was. And that's who this story is really about. That pattern of danger is not an accident. And we'll come back to it. On Sunday, the kind of day that should feel ordinary, the kind of day that shouldn't be the last time a family sees someone whole. Dee Warner's daughter had a habit, a routine she kept faithfully, a weekly visit to her mother. It seems like such a small thing, a Sunday check-in, the kind of rhythm families fall into without even thinking about it. But on this particular Sunday, something was wrong. Her daughter arrived at the property and Dee was not there. That alone might not seem alarming. People run errands. People step out. Except Dee's car was still at the house. Her phone wasn't showing activity. No calls made. No texts sent. Her bank accounts, silent. No withdrawals. No purchases. No digital footprint of any kind suggesting she'd gone somewhere willingly. No note, no message to her children, no goodbye to anyone who mattered to her. Nothing. For a woman described as deeply connected to her family, a woman whose children were central to her identity, this was not just unusual. This was alarming. Her daughter knew it immediately. That gut instinct that doesn't require explanation. The kind that hits you in the chest before your brain even catches up. She reported her mother missing. And just like that, Dee Warner's disappearance became official. Searches began quickly. Family, friends, law enforcement. They combed the property and surrounding areas. They made calls. They asked questions. They looked for anything, a footprint, a fiber, a witness, a lead. But there was nothing. No sightings of Dee after that date. No trace of her movement in any direction. No indication whatsoever that she had left voluntarily. Just absence. Heavy, deliberate, total absence. And investigators began to do what investigators do when someone vanishes without a trace and leaves behind a car and a phone and a life they clearly had no intention of abandoning. They looked at the people closest to her. They looked at the last person known to have seen Dee Warner alive, her husband, Dale Warner. In the early days of any missing person investigation, detectives work outward from the center. They start with the immediate circle, family, spouse, close friends, people with access, people with motive, people whose lives intersect most directly with the person who has vanished. And from almost the beginning of the investigation into Dee Warner's disappearance, attention kept returning to one person. Dale Warner. It wasn't one thing. It wasn't a combination of things. The kind of accumulation that investigators call a pattern. His statements, when questioned, contained inconsistencies. Not necessarily the dramatic, obvious contradictions that make for good television, but the quieter kind. The kind where timelines don't quite line up. Where details shift slightly from one conversation to the next. Where answers feel practiced rather than remembered. Family members reported that the marriage had been in serious conflict. There were arguments about money, about how the business was being run, about debts, about decisions being made without Dee's input or agreement. And then there were the conversations about divorce. Reports suggested that Dee had been considering leaving the marriage, that she had told people close to her that she was ready to move on. In the world of intimate partner violence research, the moment a partner announces they want to leave, is statistically the most dangerous. Not the middle of the relationship, not the hard years, the exit. Because for some people, the idea of losing control is more unbearable than any outcome. Despite all of this, investigators faced an enormous obstacle. Without a body, charging someone with a homicide is extraordinarily difficult. It happens, but it's hard. Prosecutors have to build an entirely circumstantial case. They have to convince a jury that someone is guilty of taking a life when there is no physical proof that life was taken. Agonizingly slowly for a family already in agony. Months passed, then a year, then two. The community didn't forget. Billboards went up along local roads. Dee's face looking out at passing cars. Her name printed in bold, asking questions that had no answers yet. Vigils were held. Her family organized. They spoke publicly. They made noise. They refused, absolutely refused, to let Dee Warner become another forgotten woman. Another case filed that gathers dust. Behind the scenes, investigators continued working. Quietly, methodically, building. And then, in November of 2023, after more than 2.5 years of searching, the investigation reached a turning point. Dale Warner was arrested, charged with murder, charged with evidence tampering. Even without a body, prosecutors had decided they had enough to move forward. But the most shattering revelation in this case, the moment that changed everything, was still several months away. And when it came, it was worse than most people feared. August 2024. Over 3 years since Dee Warner vanished on a Sunday morning and left behind a car, a phone, and a family in pieces. Investigators executed a search warrant on property connected to Dale Warner. This was not the first time authorities had searched the area, but this time they were looking in a different direction, following different information. What they found will stay with you. Concealed inside a sealed tank, a tank used for agricultural chemicals, buried within the infrastructure of the very farm operation Dee had helped build and run, were human remains. And those remains were later identified as Dee Warner. Let that sit for a moment, because I want you to fully understand the weight of what that discovery means. For 3 years, and 3 months, while her family held vigils, while her face looked out from billboards, while her children grew older without answers, while her mother and father and siblings and friends lived in that unbearable space between hope and grief, Dee was there, on that property, in a sealed container, hidden in plain sight inside a working agricultural operation. The remains were confirmed through forensic analysis. Her death was ruled a homicide. And with that confirmation, the Warner family finally had what they had spent years desperately searching for. The knowledge of what happened. Not peace. Not closure. Those words feel hollow and dishonest in a moment like this. But truth, the brutal, undeniable truth, that Dee Warner had not walked away, had not chosen to disappear, had not started a new life somewhere else. She had been murdered, and someone had gone to extraordinary lengths to make sure no one ever found her. Think about what it means for a family to receive that kind of news. On one hand, the not knowing is over. The limbo that had stretched across 3 years, 3 rounds of birthdays, 3 Christmases, 3 springs without her. That particular torture finally ends. On the other hand, what replaces it is not peace. What replaces it is the full, unfiltered weight of the truth. The knowledge that she was there the entire time. That the property where life appeared to continue normally, where trucks came and went and the fields were worked and seasons changed, held a secret that never should have been kept. There is a specific kind of grief that arrives when the worst thing you feared turns out to be exactly true. It doesn't feel like relief. It feels like the ground finally giving away beneath feet that have been suspended over for years. For Dee Warner's family, August 2024 was both an ending and a beginning. The end of searching, the beginning of grieving in full, the beginning of something that can actually eventually move forward. However, slowly. However, painfully. Because grief with a name is different from grief with no name at all. The discovery fundamentally changed the nature of the case. Before August 2024, prosecutors were building a murder charge on circumstantial evidence alone. After August 2024, they had remains. They had a confirmed homicide. They had forensic evidence from the location and condition of the body. The legal landscape shifted. The stakes escalated, and Dale Warner, already in custody, already charged, now faced the full weight of what investigators alleged he had done. Who is Dale Warner? This is always the uncomfortable chapter, the one where we try to understand the person accused without excusing them, without demonizing them into a cartoon villain. Because neither approach serves the truth. From everything in the public record, Dale Warner was a man deeply embedded in his community, a farmer, a business owner, a local figure, someone whose life was built on physical work and rural roots. By many accounts, he was not some obvious predator, not someone who stood out as dangerous. Not someone who set off immediate alarm bells in neighbors or acquaintances. And that, I have to say this clearly, is actually one of the most important things to understand about intimate partner homicide. It almost never looks like the movies. The person who commits it is not usually a stranger, not usually someone with a violent history visible to the public, not usually someone who announces their capacity for this kind of act. Most of the time, they look exactly like Dale Warner is described. Ordinary, familiar, a face you recognize. The violence, when it comes, is often the product of something private. Something that has been building for a very long time inside the walls of a home that looks perfectly normal from the outside. Investigators allege that the conflict between Dale and Dee had escalated to a breaking point. They allege that Dee's decision or her intention to leave the marriage was the catalyst. They allege that Dale Warner killed his wife, concealed her remains on their own property, and then went about his life. Filed no missing person report himself, offered no public plea for her return, let her family search, let her face go up on billboards, let years pass. If those allegations are true, and I want to be clear that Dale Warner has pleaded not guilty and that he is entitled to due process and presumption of innocence. If those allegations are true, then what we're looking at is not just a crime of passion. It's a crime of concealment, sustained, deliberate, calculated. The kind that requires a person to look their in-laws in the face, to watch their children grieve, to maintain a story, and that is its own kind of darkness. I want to take a minute here and talk about something that I think gets lost in true crime coverage. We focus on events. We focus on evidence. We focus on the trial. And all that matters. But we don't always talk about the psychological agriculture of how something like this happens. How does a marriage, any marriage, arrive at that threshold of violence? Researchers and criminologists who study intimate partner homicide have identified consistent patterns. And I'm going to walk you through them because understanding these patterns is not just academic. It could save someone's life. The cycle of control. Many intimate partner homicides occur in relationships when control has been a defining dynamic for years. Not always physical control, at least not at first. Often it's financial control, social isolation, monitoring the movements, undermining confidence. Control is not always loud. Sometimes it's the quietest thing in the room. Escalation during threat of separation. Study after study confirms it. The most dangerous time in a controlling relationship is when the controlled partner attempts to leave. When someone says, "I'm done." When they consult a lawyer. When they start moving money. When they tell friends and family what's really been happening. The moment of attempted independence can trigger the most extreme response. Because for a person who has built their sense of power on the ability to control another person, losing that control makes someone angry. The absence of prior public record. Intimate partner homicide perpetrators frequently have no visible history of violence, no criminal record, no restraining orders, no public red flags. The violence is contained within the relationship, invisible to the outside world, sometimes invisible even to family and friends. This is why well-meaning people so often say, after something like this happens, "We had no idea. He seemed so normal. They seemed happy." Because from the outside, they often do. Concealment as an extension of control. When an intimate partner homicide is followed by concealment, hiding the body, maintaining a cover story, allowing the victim's family to search, researchers suggest this behavior reflects the same psychological dynamic as the abuse itself. It's not just about avoiding legal consequences. It's about maintaining control over the narrative, over what people know, over what gets discovered, over who has power in the story. If the allegations against Dale Warner are accurate, every element of this pattern was present. And that is not coincidence. That is a blueprint. One we've seen before. One we will tragically see again, unless we learn to recognize it. Now, let me say something else. Because I am aware that sometimes in true crime, we walk about red flags and warning signs in a way that makes it sound simple. It's not simple. When you love someone, those red flags look different up close. They get explained away. They get minimized. You tell yourself a story about who this person really is. And sometimes the fear is real, genuinely paralyzing fear about what will happen if you try to leave. So I'm not standing here saying, "Why didn't she just go?" That question dismisses everything we know about how these relationships actually work. What I am saying is this. Pay attention to the people around you. Take it seriously when someone tells you they're scared. Help people make safe plans. Because sometimes the woman who needs help is too deep inside the situation to save herself. And that's when the people around her have to step up. There's something particular about cases like this one that doesn't get discussed enough. The role of geography. Lenawee County, Michigan, is not a dense urban environment. There are no surveillance cameras on every corner. No doorbell cameras watching every house from three different angles. No witnesses steps away from whatever happened. In rural America, in the wide open spaces that look so peaceful from the outside, privacy is enormous. Land is abundant. Neighbors are distant. And the things that happen behind closed doors, behind closed fences, behind locked gates on private farmland can stay private for a very long time. This is not unique in Michigan. It's a reality of rural crime that investigators grapple with constantly. When your nearest neighbor is a mile away, nobody hears the argument. Nobody sees what happens in the barn at 2 a.m. Nobody notices the truck coming and going at strange hours. Agricultural property creates additional layers of complexity. Equipment that moves earth. Tanks and containers used for legitimate farming purposes that could, under the wrong circumstances, be repurposed. And communities in rural areas sometimes carry a complex relationship with law enforcement. Not always distrust, but sometimes an agricultural code that says, we handle our own problems. That says, we don't get into people's business. That can unintentionally create cover for the wrong people. None of this means justice is impossible in rural cases. Clearly it isn't. 3 years later, charges were filed. More than 3 years later, remains were found. But it does mean that investigations in these environments require patience, resources, and a willingness to keep going long after easier investigations would have dried up. It means the family's persistence mattered. The billboards mattered. The public pressure mattered. The refusal to let Dee Warner become a forgotten woman, that mattered. Because in cases like this, silence and isolation are tools. And the antidote to those tools is noise. Relentless, sustained, public noise. I want to spend some time here talking about the people who refuse to let this case go cold. Because in the true crime world, we can sometimes fall into the habit of talking about families as secondary characters in their own tragedies. But Dee Warner's family was not a secondary character in anything. They were the engine. From the moment her daughter arrived for that Sunday visit and found only absence, from the first moment of knowing something was terribly wrong, this family drove the search. They organized. They put up billboards. They held vigils. They spoke to media. They pressed for answers. They kept showing up year after year after year. Can you imagine what that takes? I want you to actually sit with that question. Not knowing if someone you love is alive or dead, not knowing if they're suffering somewhere, not knowing if the person in your home, the person at your dinner table, knows more than they're saying. Living with the uncertainty while also grieving, while also raising children, while also trying to function in a world that eventually moves on even when you can't. That is not a passive thing. That is an act of sustained courage. Dee's family chose to make noise in a situation that would have swallowed quieter people whole. And because they made that noise, because they kept her face on those billboards, kept her name in the news, kept showing up, investigators had community pressure and public attention that they likely contributed to the sustained focus on the case. This is one of the things I believe most deeply about true crime coverage when it's done responsibly. It keeps cases alive, not for entertainment, but because attention creates accountability, and accountability moves investigations forward. Dee Warner's family understood that instinctively, and they were right. Let's go back to the investigation itself and talk about what it actually takes to build a murder case without a body, because that's where investigators spent the better part of 2.5 years, building something that could hold up in court when the most fundamental piece of evidence, the victim. In legal terms, this kind of case is called a corpus delicti case, from Latin, the body of the crime. It doesn't actually mean a physical body. It means proving that a crime occurred at all. Without physical remains, prosecutors must establish through other means that the missing person is dead rather than simply gone, that their death was the result of criminal action, and that the person on trial is responsible. That requires building a wall of circumstantial evidence. Every brick matters. Every inconsistency in statements. Every piece of financial data. Every witness account of the state of the relationship. Every behavior after the disappearance that suggests consciousness of guilt. It's painstaking work. It's not the kind of work that makes for dramatic press conferences. It happens quietly, in offices, and evidence rooms, over months and years. Investigators in the Warner case were doing exactly that, interviewing witnesses, reviewing financial records, documented inconsistencies, gathering testimony about the state of the marriage, building the case piece by patient piece. The November 2023 arrest, more than 2.5 years after Dee's disappearance, was the public-facing result of all the unseen work. The decision to charge without a body is not made lightly. It requires prosecutors to believe, with enough confidence to stake their own case on it, that the evidence they have is sufficient. And in this case, they made that call. Then, 9 months after the arrest, in August of 2024, the discovery on the property confirmed what they suspected. For the prosecution, the discovery was both confirmation and complication. Confirmation that their core theory was correct, but also the opening of new forensic questions about the exact circumstances of Dee's death and the chain of events needed to answer them. For the defense, the discovery was a significant blow. A circumstantial case, difficult but survivable, had now become a case with remains, with a confirmed homicide ruling, with forensic evidence from the scene. The trial ahead would be the final arena for all of it. As of 2026, Dale Warner has pled not guilty and faces trial on charges of murder and evidence tampering. The legal proceedings have moved through preliminary stages, with the weight of deliberateness that complex homicide cases require. Prosecutors allege that Dale Warner killed his wife during or following marital conflict and then deliberately concealed her remains on their own property, inside the agricultural infrastructure of their farm operation. The evidence tampering charge is in some ways as significant as the murder charge because it speaks to intent. It speaks to the deliberate choice to conceal, to the sustained maintenance of a cover story, to the ongoing active concealment of Dee's fate while her family searched for her. Defense attorneys of the legal system are expected to challenge the connections between Dale Warner and the specific cause of Dee's death. They will argue that the evidence, however powerful, does not definitively establish beyond reasonable doubt that their client committed the crime. That is their job. And in a country where presumption of innocence is foundational, that process matters, even when it's painful to watch from the outside. What the trial will ultimately produce is not something we can predict with certainty. What we know is this: a woman is dead. Her remains were found on property she shared with her husband. Her death was ruled a homicide. Her husband is charged with killing her. And a family has waited for justice for years. The courtroom is where all of that converges. And whatever verdict comes, it will not undo the years of not knowing. It will not give back that Sunday visit. It will not fill the chair at the table. But it can answer the questions of accountability. And for the families like Warner's, for Dee's children and her parents and her siblings and friends, accountability is not a small thing. It is everything. I want to step away from the legal proceedings for a moment and talk about something that doesn't get enough airtime. When someone you love dies, the grief is devastating, but there is a path through it. There is rituals. There is a funeral. There is a grave. There is a community that gathers around you and says, in word and presence, we acknowledge this. We grieve with you. When someone you love disappears, when you don't know if they're dead or alive, there is no path. There is no ritual. There is no grave. There is only waiting. Psychologists call it ambiguous loss. It's one of the most psychologically complex forms of grief known, because you can't grieve fully, because doing so feels like giving up hope, and you can't stop grieving, because the absence is consistent, inescapable. You live in a permanent state of suspension. These children went through that. Her parents went through that. Every person who loved her went through that. For 3 years and 3 months. 3 years and 3 months of not knowing, of waking up and wondering, of special occasions with an empty chair, of watching her face on billboards and not knowing if she would ever come home. The kind of grief leaves marks that don't fade easily. It changes how you trust, how you attach to people, how you move through the world. And even after August of 2024, even after remains were found, even after the worst was confirmed, the grief did not become simpler. It became different, because now there were new questions. Questions about what happened in detail. Questions that may be answered at trial or may never be fully answered. And the long work of processing, not just the loss, but the specific circumstances of the loss, the hidden tank, the years of concealment, the possibility that someone who sat at family gatherings knew where she was the whole time. That is a particular kind of wound. And I think we owe it to the families like this one to at least acknowledge it, not to move past it quickly, not to wrap it up neatly, but to sit in it for a moment and say, this is real. This damage is real. These people are real, and they deserve more than footnote. The Dee Warner case is a specific story, a specific woman, a specific place, a specific set of circumstances, but it exists within a much larger landscape. And if we're being honest about why this podcast exists, why true crime coverage matters when done with intention, then we have to name that larger picture. Every year in the United States, an estimated 1,500 to 2,000 women are killed by a current or former intimate partner. Every year. That number has not gone down significantly, despite decades of awareness campaigns, despite domestic violence litigations. Because the problem is not primarily a resource problem. It's a recognition problem, a culture problem, a silence problem. Most of those 1,500 to 2,000 women were not surprised by what happened to them. Most of them had told someone. Most of them had shown signs. The gap between the red flags and tragedy is often filled by minimization. It's not that bad. He didn't actually hit me. He would never really do anything. Isolation. The victim has been slowly separated from support systems and has no one left to turn to. Resources. Financial dependency that makes living feel impossible. Fear. Real, documented, justifiable fear that leaving will escalate rather than end the danger. And silence, the cultural expectation that what happens in a marriage is private, that we don't get involved, that it's not our place. All of those forces conspire to keep women in dangerous situations long past the point where they should have been safe. And all of those forces were likely present in Dee Warner's situation. I am not saying this to assign blame to anyone around her. People in these situations rarely have clear information. The dynamic is designed to obscure it. I'm saying it because understanding these forces is the only way to begin to dismantle them. And dismantling them starts with conversations like this one. With being willing to say the uncomfortable thing, to take the call, to show up for someone who seems to be quietly struggling, to ask the direct question, to believe the answer. One conversation, one moment of not looking away. That is sometimes the difference. I think about my responsibility a lot. Every case I bring to the show is someone's real life, someone's real family, someone's real wound. And I make choices constantly about how I tell it. What to include, what to leave out, how graphic to get, when to pull back, how to honor the victim without reducing them to their victimhood. The Dee Warner story is one that has been covered by local and national media. It's been discussed in true crime communities. Her family has been public about their fight for answers. In cases like this, media attention is not just incidental, it's functional. Billboards work. Community pressure works. Public memory works. Because investigations have limited resources. Detectives have caseloads. Cold cases compete for attention. And when the cameras move on, when the hashtags fade, when the visuals become less frequent, cases can slip. But when a community refuses to let go, when podcasters and journalists and family advocate, keep a name in circulation, keep a face visible, it creates a kind of sustained accountability that the formal justice system alone cannot always maintain. I believe that. I have seen it be true. And I believe it was true in Dee Warner's case. The people who kept showing up, the family with the billboards, the journalists who kept filing stories, a true crime community that kept talking, all of them were in their own way. Part of what led to that August 2024 discovery. That is not a claim I make lightly, but I believe it is accurate, and it is why this show exists. But to remember, to witness, to refuse to look away from what is uncomfortable and true. Before we close, I want to be practical because I think true crime has a responsibility that goes beyond storytelling. It is a responsibility to be useful. So here are the things I want you to take from today's episode. First, trust the instinct of people around you. When a friend or family member expresses fear about a relationship, when they say things that hint at control or conflict, when they seem like they're slowly disappearing even before they actually disappear, take it seriously. Don't minimize. Don't rationalize. Don't tell them it'll get better. Ask direct questions. Offer concrete help. Second, understand the statistics around separation. The most dangerous time in an abusive relationship is when the victim tries to leave. If you're helping someone leave a dangerous situation, do it carefully. Do it with a plan, not impulsively. Safety planning is real, and it saves lives. Resources like the National Domestic Violence Hotline exist specifically to help with this. Third, don't underestimate geographic isolation. If someone you care about is in a rural or isolated situation with limited access to community transportation or outside support, be more proactive about maintaining contact. Don't assume silence means everything is fine. Fourth, remember that financial control is abuse. Dee's case involved financial disputes and business disagreements, economic abuse, controlling a partner's access to money, undermining their professional contribution, creating dependency is one of the most common forms of intimate partner abuse. And it is one of the least visible. It doesn't leave bruises, but it creates the condition for other harm to flourish. Fifth, keep asking questions. When someone vanishes and it doesn't add up, when the car is still there and the phone is silent and the money isn't moving, keep asking. Push for answers. Demand that investigators stay open. Make noise. Because sometimes noise is what keeps the search going long enough to find the truth. I want to end this by saying something directly to Dee Warner's family. If anyone who ever loved her is listening to this, I want you to know that her name is not forgotten. That life she built, the love she gave, the person she was, none of that has been erased. The darkness of what happened to her does not diminish the brightness of who she was and the fight you fought for her. The years of billboards and visuals and sleepless nights and refusing to accept silence. That is one of the most profound acts of love I have encountered in years I have spent in this space. She was lucky to be loved that fiercely, and the world was lucky to have her in it. I also want to say something to anyone listening tonight who recognized something in this story, who heard a detail and felt a chill of recognition, not because of the crime, but because of the relationship, the financial tension that never quite gets resolved, the sense that your voice matters less than it should in your own home, the feeling that leaving would be complicated, would cost too much, would create consequences you're not ready to face. If any part of today's story felt similar in a way you didn't expect, please take that seriously. Not with panic, but with honesty. Talk to someone, a friend, a family member, a counselor. Call the hotline. Make a plan. Because Dee Warner's story is not just a cautionary tale about what one person did. It is a reminder that when warning signs appear, the time to act on them is before they become something irreversible. You deserve safety. You deserve a life where you don't disappear. If there's one thing this work teaches me over and over, case after case, it's this. Monsters rarely announce themselves. They smile at you. They pass you the bread at dinner. They show up to the community gathering. They live completely ordinary lives, right up until the moment they don't. And the only defense we have, the only real defense, is each other. Paying attention, seeing the uncomfortable thing, refusing to look away, remembering the people who can no longer speak for themselves. That is what we do here. That is what Dee Warner family did for 3 years. That is what I will keep doing for as long as I have a microphone. For Dee. Not because of the numbers. Because the more people who hear Dee Warner's name, the more people who understand the patterns in her story, the greater the chance that someone somewhere recognizes those patterns in their own life or in the life of someone they love and does something about it. That is the whole point. Until next time, stay aware, stay compassionate, keep searching for the truth, and remember, the monsters among us count on our silence. Don't give it to them. I'm Maya Vale. This is Among Monsters.